morning. My name is Mary Ann White, and I'm an alcoholic. The date of my last drink is September the 2nd, 1977. So you have two members of the class of 1977 up here. My home group is the... Thank you. My home group is the Early Morning Fellowship of Men and Women. We are a big book study, and we meet at 6:30 in the morning on Mondays and Fridays. If you're ever in Corpus, I certainly... I encourage you to attend our meeting. This microphone business is something I'm going to share with you. Be careful how you sit around and point fingers and laugh and titter about other things that go on to other people. I was at a conference in Memphis, and they were having microphone trouble, and when I spoke, the microphone worked perfectly. And I sat there very smugly just pointing my finger at the poor lady who was trying to do this, and I thought, you know, really what goes around comes around. And I thought, this is going to be one of those times, so I'm very grateful for this system right now. I'm also very grateful that I have been asked to speak here today. It has been said that it is an honor and a privilege always to do anything at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, you're going to hear a lot of words from me. I talk very fast, and all of a sudden I kept thinking about, wonder if I don't have as much time. And I thought, you know how fast I'm going to have to talk to get an hour and 50-minute talk in about 50 minutes? It was going to have to be fast. And the words we use, my heart at this time is very full. And I would like to thank the people that have made it possible for me to be here. First of all, Bob. I met Bob in Omaha, and Frank. I met Frank in Omaha, and I would like to thank you so much. Everybody who has been so kind to me at this meeting, and the people that I would really like to thank are Linda and Dave. Linda and Dave were the hands of Alcoholics Anonymous when we came in here on Thursday night. And for those of you that when you look at me, it looks like that I should be able to do a whole lot of things. But there are many times in my life that I'm still very anxious. And when I came in Thursday night, I had that anxiety. And we sat at Linda and Dave's table, and they have opened up their hearts to us. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. I have some really good news, and I have some really bad news. The good news is Alcoholics Anonymous works very, very well. The bad news is that Alcoholics Anonymous works very slowly. It was explained to me that sobering up in Alcoholics Anonymous was like being kicked to death by rabbits. I also have two members of my home group here. You know, people who stand up at podiums, we can talk Alcoholics Anonymous real well. But if you want to know if I know how to work a program, and not only know how to work a program, but do work a program, you speak to these two ladies that are sitting on the front row. They see me day in, and they see me day out. You also speak to the clerk at the grocery store. You speak to my husband. You speak to my kids. You speak to the sales clerk that I'm dealing with, and you'll see if Alcoholics Anonymous works. I don't know how many of you have been privileged to go to the international conferences, and the first one I went to was in 1980, and it was in New Orleans, Louisiana. There were 45,000 of us, members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, wandering around the streets of New Orleans, and we were having a grand and glorious time. And when we were there, there was a reporter that was interviewing the mayor of New Orleans. And he had this microphone in the mayor's face, and he was asking the mayor these very inane questions, like, you know, how is the city going to handle all these people, moving them around? How are the restaurants going to handle these people who have turned into grand little eaters once we sobered up? You know, all these things. And he finally stuck the microphone in the mayor's face, and he asked him this very inane last question. He said, "Mayor, do you think Alcoholics Anonymous works?" And the mayor reared back, and he looked at him, and he said, "Son, this town is in big trouble if it doesn't." I told you my group is a big book study, and we read from front to back. We start at the front, and in the beginning, I only wanted to go through the first 164 pages, but we decided that it was imperative that people identify, and that's where the stories were important. And there is a line in one of the stories that is very pertinent to me. It's in those golden years. And it says, "The need to uphold a facade had been irksome." Now, if I get a chance to read that, my very next comment is, no shit. You're looking at somebody who spends a lot of time on the outside. Even well into sobriety, I work real hard on the facade. And that is an area that Alcoholics Anonymous is taking a lot of years to crack through. I'm going to share with you what I believe about this program and how I follow the directions that are in this book. And there again, I'm going to tell you a little story about being really careful what you pray for. I get up every morning and I get down on my knees and I say my prayers. You know, sometimes I get up here and I kind of talk in vague terms about what I do to stay sober. But I hope today that God is going to allow me to be real specific. I get down on my knees and I ask that God keep me sober today. And then I read. I have a bunch of stuff that I read. And then what I do is I go out, and I used to run, but I walk now. And I usually get out in the morning and I walk, and then I come back and I get ready for the day. And one of the things that I do is I say the third step prayer and I say the seventh step prayer. And I say the seventh step prayer exactly as it's outlined in the book. But then I read in the grapevine that this gentleman thought it was imperative for him to name the baby, that he needed to name the character defect that he thought he and God were working on at that time. And I thought, that's good. So I say the seventh step prayer as outlined, and then I say it again. And I throw in self-pity and self-loathing. And then I talk about my jealousy. You know, the book says that the jealousy is that most terrible of all human emotions. The very first emotion I ever felt, as my very first conscious emotion I ever felt, was jealousy. I wanted something that somebody else had. And I found it later on, you all helped me, I didn't want to do the work. I wanted it to be given to me. And then I say the seventh step prayer, and I kind of lump it all together, and I say greed and gluttony and sloth and pride. And then I throw in this one at the insistence of my sponsor. I throw in vanity. I spend far too much time on clothes, on my hair. I spend far too much money on clothes. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous and they were talking about a treatment center, one of the reasons I did not go to a treatment center is they said they took your makeup away. I almost got struck sober with that thought. So I really do work on this defect of character called vanity, which hooks into pride, which hooks into ego. And so I say this seven-step prayer, and I went out one morning and ran and came back and had said my seven-step prayer, and I got ready to go on my day. And it was one of those days, and the only way I can explain it was a good hair day. It was the day that my hair went into place real easily, and my makeup went on real easily, and I had this dress. Oh, God, I bought this dress, and I'd been waiting for this dress to go on sale, and you gentlemen are going to have to kind of bear with me on this one, because, you know, maybe you can identify if you wanted a shotgun or a fishing rod anything, but I wanted this. I mean, I knew, you know, as a little child, I remember thinking, if I could get 100 crayons for Christmas, I would be happy. And I badgered my family. God, I followed them around, and I cut out pictures, and I taped it on things. I wanted that 100 crayons. I had to have that 100 crayons. And Christmas morning came, and there were the 100 crayons. My mind said I should have asked for 200. So I've got this dress, and it's a beautiful silk dress, and it's got an A-line skirt. That's the only way I can explain it. It had this lovely A-line skirt. It was made out of silk, and I put this dress on, and I looked in the mirror, and all I could think of was, not too shabby, not too shabby. And then I thought, my God, Marion, you have just prayed a prayer about vanity, and then I dismissed it. I just dismissed that thought. Now, that should tell you I'm in for trouble. I sobered up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and there was a woman there that kept referring to her alcoholism, and her name was Liz. And Liz was a streetwalker. She was a prostitute, and I was just fascinated by her. I mean, I would try to sit next to her, and I would listen to what she'd say, and then what I'd do is I'd look at her hands, and I'd think, my God, I wonder what she's done with those hands. And then I thought, I wonder if she'll teach me what she's done with those hands. So she used to say about this fellow who sat on her her shoulder here, on her left shoulder, and she had a name for him, and it was her alcoholism, and her alcoholism was always telling her that you didn't need to go to the meetings, you didn't need to share with the people, you didn't need to talk to these people, you could cut back, you didn't need to pray, it was okay to lie, all this stuff. This is what her alcoholism, and I finally got courage enough to ask her one day, what is your alcoholism's name? And she goes, it's that motherfucker Leroy. So Leroy is telling me it's okay to go on and pursue my vanity. And so I went to my meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a grand and a glorious meeting. It was a noon meeting, and came out of my meeting and went to the bathroom and then went about my day. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the gift, and it truly is a gift, of being able to function in the world. I mean, I can do a whole lot of things, and I went in and out of several shopping malls, and I went to the post office, and I went to the cleaners, and I am just wandering around Corpus Christi, Texas, and I begin to notice that I'm getting more attention than I normally get. And that old ego and that old vanity kicks in, and I'm throwing my shoulders back, and the attention I'm getting are there workmen digging in the street, and they stop digging. And they lean on their shovels, and they're poking one another, and they're pointing. And I think I'll walk a little further tomorrow. This walking is really paying off. There are two little boys that are riding a bicycle, and they almost have a wreck. And they stop riding their bicycle, and they're laughing, and they're kind of pointing. And I thought, those young men have good taste. They will most likely marry women who preserve themselves very well. There was a man at the shopping mall, and there was like a pillar like that, and he's looking at me, and he's kind of turning around, walking backwards, almost walks into the pillar, and I thought, oh, I hope his wife takes as good a care of herself as I do me, and just basking in this. And I go into a small shop, and I find Jenny, my friend. And she looks at me, and she said, what is wrong with your skirt? I said, what do you mean, what's wrong with my skirt? And what had happened some 4 hours earlier is I had tucked the bottom of my skirt into the top of my pantyhose, and I had been mooning half of Corpus Christi for 4 hours. Now, I watch your faces when I tell this story, and I was telling it at a conference, and there was a woman, and she was appalled. I mean, I don't know if she was an Al-Anon or not, but she was appalled that I told this story, and she came up later on, and she said, I am so glad you had on underpants. And I said to her, I didn't have on any underpants. 22 years ago, I could not have told anybody that story because I took myself so seriously. I'm going to tell you some more stories real fast about what I was like, what happened to me, and what I am like today. And this is crucial, the work that Alcoholics Anonymous has done on me. I'm an only child. You know, Marcia was talking about being the middle child. Well, I'm the only child. And by God, I pointed the finger, I'm the only child. I had old parents. My father was 45 and my mother was 40. And she truly was the untreated Al-Anon. And I came into this program. This is what happens with perception. I came into this program and I told almost 10 years sober, still telling this story about my mother. At the age of 12 years old, I got a card from my mother, a Mother's Day card. And I went up and I wrote on this Mother's Day card how much I loved her. And I brought it down and I gave this card to her. And what happened was this. She made fun of it. That's not what happened at all. What happened was she didn't read the script. Her responses, and it took me almost 10 years in this program to identify this, her responses to my reaching out still did not fill the void that was inside of me. So here I am, this only child, and I am just a very precocious brat. I caught it from my dad. I could identify with him immediately that if a little bit's good, a lot's better. And my father had abused his body terribly as far as his drinking. But he found Alcoholics Anonymous, and my father died a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. At 9 years of age, he was in a charity hospital in Kansas City, Missouri, and my mother had said to me, I have to work, you're going to have to go visit your dad. And at 9 years of age, she told me how to get on a bus and transfer and find this old charity hospital and wind my way through the bowels of this hospital and somehow or another find my husband, my father, in this charity ward with these 40 other old men that were dying and that were sick, somehow try to make a connection with this old man and then do it again. And I did this for weeks and I did it for months. And I never once went home and said to my mother, please don't make me do that. I never once said to my mother, I'm afraid. At the age of 15, I wanted out of that house because there was going to be a lot of responsibility. And I did what women of my age did. I thought, if I can find a man, if I can find a Mr. Right, then I will be okay. And at the age of 15, I'm married and I'm pregnant. And I'm lying on my back in a hospital and they place this baby in my arms and I have never even held a baby. And they placed this little baby in my arms, and three thoughts went through my mind, that I'm going to be the best mother, and that I was afraid. I did allow those thoughts to come in for just a brief moment. And then the third thought, and this is one of the thoughts that probably got me to you and can isolate me faster than anything else, is I'm going to ask no one for help. I will do this all by myself. When we were living on the East Coast, and this is another part of my personality, we went to a dinner, and it was a raffle, and you could get gifts, and luck would have it, I won 4 gifts that night. It never once crossed my mind to say, one is enough. One is enough. Let somebody else have some. So you see, I'm selfish, I'm not going to ask anybody for help, and I'm frightened, and I'm just an alcoholic waiting to happen. And it happened this way. This is the way my story went, and this is the way a lot of women go. It was very subtle. Alcohol had a siren song for me. It was seductive. And there was always the rationalization and justification. And one night, my husband and I are going to have a drink before dinner. It's just that simple. And so I knew that I had some kind of a solution and some kind of an answer. And the other thing that alcohol did for me, and this was important that I find this out about myself early on, is that alcoholics are perfectionists. We are also idealists. An idealist cannot live in this imperfect world without some kind of a crutch, without some kind of a buffer. You know, this is why the first 2 years of sobriety were so crucial and so difficult. Because as a result of stopping drinking, I had been stripped. All my insulation was off. All my defenses were gone. And I would wander around meetings saying, I can't stand this. I can't do this. How do you do life with no defenses? And what happened is my sponsor would say to me, we're going to give you a set of defenses. And I said, like what? And she said, like honesty. I said, no, lying is a defense. Honesty is not a defense. She said, it will become a defense. And so I've got a husband, and I've got we have 2 children. What happened is that alcohol softened the world. It changed me, but it also changed the world. That it was not, the world got softer and the world got easier. And my drinking career was long enough. My drinking career started absolutely as one drink before dinner. And at the end of my drinking in 1977, I am drinking around the clock. I told you I sobered up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I used to go to a lot of meetings where there were steel workers. And I wanted a story as bad as they had. And I began to pick up on their story. And, you know, I've never been in jail. I'd never wrecked a car. I never lost any family members. You know, I had not done all that, but I began to tell you that I had done these things. And it was explained to me that I needed to tell my own story, and I needed to find my own story. So I did drink around the clock, and I would carry bottles in my purse and underneath the seat in the car. And I was a great cook, and I kept them behind the cookbook, and I kept it in the spice rack and all that stuff. And I kept thinking that I was really public drinker but a private drunk. Well, the longer I was sober, I realized I was much more publicly drunk than I ever want to think about. And here's a story that I was on an airplane, and I was in the middle seat, and I had this huge bottle of vodka, and I thought I drank surreptitiously out of that bottle of vodka, and nobody saw me. I mean, I don't even, there are a lot of stories that I had a husband that's like, I have a husband who knew there was something horribly wrong with me. And he decided that he was going to administer what's called a sniff kiss. And I don't know how many of you have been the recipient of that kind of kiss. Well, what he would do, it never dawned on me not to drink till he got home. And I was drinking around the clock. And then I'd fry some onions, which would smell the house up a little bit. And then he would come in and try give me this sniff kiss. And I thought, you know, somehow or another, I have got to foil this man. And one day I was standing at the kitchen sink and I was eating peanut butter by the spoonful. And I thought, you know what? Peanut butter has a wonderful pungent odor. I will use peanut butter as a detractor. And I didn't want to eat it because it would spoil the buzz that I was working on that time. So the minute I saw his car drive into the driveway, I took peanut butter and stuffed it up both my nostrils. Now, when he administered his sniff kiss, I darn near choked to death. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous thinking that was the insanity. It's not. The insanity is the fact that I kept getting into trouble, and the trouble was getting deeper and deeper and deeper. The main trouble that I was getting into, and I didn't even realize it until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I mean into Alcoholics Anonymous, was that I was separating myself from a power greater than myself, who had taken a keen, fine interest in me. Who has taken a keen, fine interest in each one of us. I drank around the clock, and I did all kinds of bizarre things, and I just went deeper and deeper and deeper into this this hole that is alcoholism, active alcoholism. I loved to get my kids off to school or away to school and my husband on a business trip, and then I would sit there and drink by myself and listen to Peggy Lee's song, Is That All There Is? I loved that. And you talked about feeling sorry for yourself, and self-pity was a great character defect. And I couldn't see it. See, there. The other day we were dealing with a woman in Corpus Christi, and she has this terrible, horrible character defect. Horrible. It is obvious to everybody in the whole AA community about her character defect, and everybody has worked with her about this. And I was trying to work with her. And I'm driving home from a meeting, and I literally have to pull my car off the road because this thought came to me. If she has this character defect that she cannot see, oh, my God, I wonder if I have one. I wonder if I have one that I am absolutely so blind to. Everybody else sees it except me. The summer of 1977, I'm drinking and crying and boo-hooing and feeling sorry for myself and pointing the finger at my husband. It's him. He caused it all. If I hadn't had to move around the country, if I hadn't been married at the age of 15, if I hadn't been a mother at 15, if he would only tell me he loved me as much as I needed to be told that he loved me, if he was more passionate, on and on and on. I had a litany. There was a row of hooks that I hung my alcoholism on, and most of them had his name on them. And I got up and I went into the bathroom, and I forget which of the wonderful speakers talked about that moment, that brief moment. And I looked in the mirror and I saw me. And I had long hair as I do today, but I had long bangs. And it was important that I had these long bangs because I didn't want you looking into my eyes. My mother had told me early on that the eyes were the window to the soul. And I knew that if you looked into my eyes, you would see not only that nobody was home, but there was no woman in there. There was no person of character. There was no woman of substance. There was a shell, a hollow shell of a person. And so I had these long bangs, and I was 25 pounds heavier than I am today, and I looked in the mirror, and for the very first time in my life, I uttered what I believe is the true prayer of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you all know what it was. God, help me. It wasn't his fault anymore. It wasn't their fault. It was me. And all I could think about is the problem lies within me. That prayer, I was arrogant enough to say that that was the prayer that got me to Alcoholics Anonymous, but who knows which prayer. It was the prayers of my family members, my husband, my kids, members of Alcoholics Anonymous who at meetings in that time were praying for the alcoholic who is still sick and suffering, for church groups who pray for the alcoholic, for people who just go around blessing people. Who knows what prayer got me here? But what happened was this. I ended up going to a woman counselor. I was in and out of a blackout. My daughter got me to this counselor, and she said to me, "Miss," I went drunk, and she said to me, "Mrs. White, what's your problem?" And I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And I looked down at my shoes because I was waiting for the lecture, and you all know what the lecture consisted of, pretty much like we read yesterday, what the book tells us that we try to do. Get more exercise, get less exercise, read inspirational books, get a job, lose weight, gain weight, on and on and on. And it always ended, this lecture always ended like this. "And why don't you drink like a lady?" And she uttered what I believe were the three most beautiful words I have ever heard in my whole life, still to this day, "So am I." And all of a sudden, this 9-year-old girl was not alone anymore. That I was not by myself. And she talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, and all I could think of was, "My God, I know about AA. Can't you give me some kind of a pill? Can't you give me some kind of a crash course on alcoholism so that I don't have to go to AA?" And she said, "No, can you not drink?" And I said, "Of course I cannot drink." And she said, "I'll meet you at a meeting tonight." And she told my daughter about Alcoholics Anonymous. My daughter was with me. And I was full of resolve not to drink anymore that day and to go to that meeting. Well, I knew nothing about the phenomenon of craving. That once I took the drink, and this is important that we say this, so many times people that have gone further down talk about that, "By God, I took a drink, and then I took another drink, and then I took another drink," and that's the phenomenon of craving. The phenomenon of craving can be as subtle as this. I didn't always take another drink, but I wanted another drink, and that I was horribly uncomfortable and restless and irritable and discontent. That's the phenomenon of craving. The phenomenon of craving also is this. I would have 2 drinks for 4 days. But inside, I knew sooner or later I was going to finish the drunk. So I knew nothing about this phenomenon of craving, and what happened was this. The phenomenon of craving grew really strong. And all I could hear, Leroy is talking to me, and he's telling me, "You can do this by yourself. You don't have to go to AA." And I tell my daughter, "I can do this by myself." And at that point, she had hidden all the liquor except the one bottle that they can never find. And she went to bed that night, and I got up, and I got a big glass of grapefruit juice and vodka, and I took a swig of that, and the most miraculous thing happened. The most miraculous thing. The grace of God happened that night, and it happened this way. It didn't do anything for me. And I remember thinking, it's over. It's over. It's finished. And my daughter came down and she said, "Mom, what's in that glass?" And I said, "It's grapefruit juice." And she said, "Let me smell it." And I said, "Christine, didn't that lady tell you that this was an honest program?" I ended up going to detox. And I ended up going to detox at St. Francis Hospital in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's an old, old hospital. They mix the crazy people in with the alcoholics. And you know what? I knew who was crazy, and I knew who was an alcoholic. Almost immediately, that identification. It's like a friend of mine who takes a meeting like that into an institution in Texas, and they're crazy people, and they're alcoholics. And he said, "I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would like you to sort out the alcoholics. I'm going to have a meeting of AA." And she never once looks at that. Any kind of chart or any kind of graph, she moves this woman and nudges this man. And he's amazed that she can do this. And he said to her one day, "How do you know who's crazy? And how do you know who's an alcoholic?" And she said, "It is really simple." She said, "The crazy people sit there very quietly." She said, "The alcoholics are always up at the desk telling us how to run this place." And I knew that I had come home. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on the 9th floor of St. Francis Hospital. And the man was telling his story, and he had stabbed his wife in a blackout. And all I could think of was, "My God, I'm in with drug addicts and murderers." And I said to the little nurse sitting next to me, I'm going. And she said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to faint. And I fainted at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But hope was born. You know, we say these words over and over and over again. Hope. Hope. There was something inside of me that I was going to, that somehow or another I was going to be all right. But I'm still crazy as a loon. My husband says I'm a 10 on the weird shit-o-meter. I just, you know, just crazy as a loon. Just absolutely bizarre. Just bizarre behavior. And I came into AA keeping you people at arm's distance because I thought if I let you in, you're going to see really and truly that it's not alcoholism, that it's I'm nuts, I'm just crazy. And that kept me so sick. I went to a lady, the therapist called a lady in my neighborhood from Alcoholics Anonymous, and she said, there is a woman in your neighborhood, would you see her? And she came and she made the call, and the call was also that wonderful time of looking into her eyes. Oh, God, I looked into her eyes, and they were beautiful, and they were clear. And she had had a very hard life, but she seemed to be doing okay with life. And she said, do you want to go to a meeting? And I said, yes. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and absolutely fell in love with Alcoholics and just, get a sponsor. Will you be my sponsor? Home group, where's the book? Let me sign up. I just love it. People would stand up here and tell their stories, and I was just fascinated by these stories. But I was full of yes buts. In Corpus, we say yes but is the mating call of the assholes. Yes but I'm not as bad. Yes but I haven't lost a husband. Yes but I was never jailed. Yes but I didn't go as far down as you did. And they kept saying, keep coming back. And I saw those steps, and all I could think of was, I have a slight case of alcoholism. I don't have to work those steps. And for 17 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, I went around doing crazy, wild things. I would let my hair flow down, and I would go into bars on the north side of Pittsburgh and say, my name is Marianne. I'm an alcoholic. I have the answer. Please come follow me. Nobody followed me, but it kept me sober. And I just discounted that I was going to have to experience an entire psychic change if I wanted permanent sobriety. Just discounted it. And I remember they talked about these steps, and I thought, how can the steps change you? You can't, I can change the color of my hair. I do periodically. I can do that. I can change the color of my eyes. I can use colored contacts. But how can I change me? And I would sit there quietly in the book, the 12 and 12, Marcia talks about silent scorn. And I would sit there and point fingers, not physically, but mentally, point fingers. I don't have to do that. You have to do it. I don't have to do it. And let me tell you how I realized what change is all about. I was at the Allegheny River in Pittsburgh, and I found a piece of broken Coke bottle. It was much like Mitchell and his story of the hot water. I found a piece of broken Coke bottle, and the piece of broken Coke bottle had the real jagged edge. You know how a piece of glass looks when it's broken? It had its original shape. It still looked like the piece of broken glass. But the river had worn all the edges off so that you could take your finger and run it all around the edges of this piece of broken glass, and it didn't cut. And that's what AA does. It wears off our edges so that hopefully with God's grace that we don't cut, that we don't hurt as many people as we have done before. At 17 months sober, my husband calls me into the kitchen and he said, Marianne, it's not that I don't love you. It's I can't live with you any longer. And I thought, okay. Here it is. I am constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. I have no courage. I have no character. I've hidden all this from you. And I have no wherewithal to get through any type of living difficulty. And I thought, I'm going to be forced to drink. And I come from the line of sobriety that says if it's your home group night, you better be there. And it was Tuesday night, and I went to my dressed up and went to my home group and walked in, and they said to me, "Marianne, how are you?" And you know what my answer was? Fine. And later on in the evening, when we were washing the dishes, I collapsed in their arms and I said to them, I told them the true story. Told them the truth. And I said, "I can't do this anymore by myself. Please help me." If you have not had an experience like that, I pray that God blesses you with the greatest gift He can give you, which is one of needing another human being. And my sobriety at that point took off like a rocket, because I began to work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there are a lot of things you can do. We talk about we want some relief. Oh, I can go to 10 meetings in 10 hours, and I can get relief. I can call my sponsor and whine on her shoulder for 10 times, and I can get relief. I can get relief from all this stuff. I can chair 15 meetings, and I can get relief. I can work with another alcoholic, and I can get relief. But if I want freedom, freedom from this stuff, I'm going to have to work the steps. I did it exactly as my sponsor did it. I did the third step on my knees with her, and I did the seventh step prayer with her. I did the fourth and fifth step. I did my fifth step with a priest. I'm not Catholic, but it was imperative that I do it because she had done it with the priest. And I went to Father Ben one day, and it was cold, one of those cold days in the Northeast where that it's so cold that the snow crunches under your feet. And I was sitting there in the car looking at this monastery, and I was apprehensive. For the longest time I said I was fearful, but I wasn't. I was apprehensive. But what went through my mind, and it's the thing that goes through my mind every time I take any kind of positive action, not activity, action in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I am in the right place at the right time. And I went into Father Ben, and he and I sat down, and he asked me to start talking and to start reading. And what happened to me was what I had been afraid was going to happen. I started to cry. And I thought, my God, I'm never going to stop crying. These were not those crocodile tears that I had shed when I was drinking. These were real tears. And these were tears that should have been shed many, many years ago. These were tears of grief. These were tears of sadness. These were tears of finally realizing the damage that I had done to my family. When I came in, I was one of these women or parents that said I had not done any damage to my children, because I had cooked their food and washed their clothes and been the scout mother and the den mother and the Sunday school teacher. I had done all those things. But I had forgotten the stories, like when my son was 12 years old and my husband and I were having a fight and I was losing the fight, and it was a fight over my alcoholism, about my drinking. And, you know, as an alcoholic, my greatest defense has got to be an attack. And I was losing this defense. I mean, I was losing the fight, and I remember thinking, I've got to do something that will help me to win this fight. And so what I did, we lived in a house that had several sets of stairs, and I thought, I'm going to throw myself down this set of stairs, but I'm going to be real careful because I don't want to hurt myself. And I'm figuring out how I'm going to throw myself down this flight of stairs, and I finally do, and I throw myself down this flight of stairs. And as I get to the bottom of this flight of stairs, my 12-year-old son, our 12-year-old son, comes out of his bedroom, and he has tears streaming down his cheeks, and he says, "Please stop it." Now, he doesn't know what he's seen. He doesn't know if his father has just thrown his mother down the steps. He doesn't know if his mother is still into active alcoholism. He doesn't know what he's seen. So when I'm crying these tears, when I'm doing my fifth step, they were tears also that I realized that one of the greatest character defects I have, one of the greatest, if you want to use the word sin, that I did when I was drinking, is that I used love as a weapon. I withheld love. I withheld the pat on the back. I withheld the word of encouragement, which takes me back to that character defect of jealousy, which takes me back to pride, which takes me back to my ego. We talk about the resilience of the alcoholic ego. Absolutely, it is the strongest thing. You know, one of the other stories that happened to me 2 weeks ago is that I'm at a conference and you all are paying for my room, and it's grand and it's glorious, and I'm looking out over this beautiful lake. Just, it's wonderful, and I'm so serene and so full of myself. And I'm looking out, and I look down, and the people below me have balconies. And I don't have a balcony. And my window all of a sudden got real small. The thought that went through my mind was this: at 21 and a half years sober, I don't have that. Next thought, I want that. The next thought, and this is the thought that scares me more than anything else: what can I do to get that? Now, I've been around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough. My next thought was, go, God, please help me. Please help me. So I worked these steps, and Bob and I are going through this nasty divorce. Talk about the division of money, property, and prestige. You can see me afterwards. I'll tell you long stories about that. We're going through this divorce, and I'm driving an old car. I'm working selling children's clothes for minimum wage, and I am full of recovery. That's the only way I can say it. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is wonderful. It waits there to swoop you up. And what it did to me, it came to me and it said to me, Marianne, we've heard about your trouble. And this one gentleman said, but you're going to take something really precious to your next relationship. And of course, my little mind said, I'm never going to have a next relationship. And I said, okay, Bill, what's that precious thing? And he said, you're going to take a healthy personality to the next relationship. I'm going to work one day after Bob and I have been separated for 2 years, and going to work one day, and I hit a man, a woman hits me broadside, and I hit a man on a bicycle, and I end up with this man on the hood of my car. And I finally get the car stopped, and I said what I knew to say, oh dear God, don't let me drink, don't let me drink. And they had ring the car. I was in a bad part of Pittsburgh. They ring the car, and they were going to pull me out and kill me. And all of a sudden, the next thought was, I'm not going to drink. I have a daily reprieve based upon the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And I had maintained that morning. And I had a spiritual condition. And it may not be the best, but it was mine. And as a result of that accident, I took the Pittsburgh meeting list and a lipstick. And a woman stuck her head in the car, and she said, is there anybody you want me to call? And I said, yes. And my husband picked me up at the police station. And we went home, and we began to sit and talk like people who had a history. Now, I'm going to tell you this. The fact that he left for those 2 years was probably the most loving thing that God could do for me, because I would still be blaming him. I may have gotten drunk if I had not had those 2 years to begin to look at me, to find out what made me tick, to find out the causes and conditions that made a problem drinker of me in the first place. I remember looking at him that morning thinking, my, how he's changed. And he hadn't changed at all. He had not changed one iota. What had happened is that Alcoholics Anonymous had begun its work on me. And as a result of that accident, Bob and I get back together. We're like that's in the book also. It talks about there should be no undue haste for families to get back together. I have to be sure of my sobriety. And it talks about we have to work on a new relationship because the former one did not work. And so Bob and I are very careful today that we don't go to those nasty, ugly places. And I'll tell you, it's very difficult. It's very difficult. Being married at the age of 15, we have played some of the sickest games. Oh, I mean, we have done parent-child. We have done good guy, bad guy. I mean, good guy, bad guy to the point of, like, where I never expressed any anger when I first sobered up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, I can get angry. My sponsor would tell me things, you know, if you stay sober, you have a chance to be right. That had never happened to me, that I had a chance to be right. It was just impossible for me to have a chance to be right. In 1984, this was in 81, and in 84, Bob said to me, would you like to move to Texas? And I said yes. And then the fear came over me. Is there any Alcoholics Anonymous in Texas? Are there any drunks? And I came to Corpus and fell in love with it. And also, it was important that that I grow up. And I had stayed in the womb of Alcoholics Anonymous in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania for 7 years, and one of the greatest gifts that was given to me was they said to me, now, Marianne, when you go down to Corpus, don't tell them how we did it in Pittsburgh. But, of course, you know what I did. I did. But what happened to me is I felt lonely and I felt isolated, and I remember thinking, they haven't seen me sick. And I remember being at a meeting thinking, I don't think I'm going to go on with this. I think I'm sober long enough that I won't have to go to meetings. And what happened to me was I was in a motel room with my husband in Brownsville, Texas, and my husband still drinks. And this is also part of my story. For those of you who say that you cannot be around alcohol, that you cannot maintain your sobriety, and that you have to get rid of absolutely everything, I'm here to say he drinks daily. Which, what does that tell me I have to do? I have to redouble my spiritual program. I have to stay so close to you people. I'm in this hotel room in Brownsville, Texas, and all of a sudden that bottle looks good. And I thought, I need to get my backside to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need to find a seat, and I need to put my name on that seat, and I need to sit there until I'm comfortable. And that's exactly what I did. I quit taking my emotional pulse. Am I happy? Do I like it? Do they like me? All that bizarre stuff that goes on in my head. And I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous in Corpus. And then my husband came home in 1989, in 88, in fact, and he said to me, would you like to move one more time? And I said, where? And he said, well, it's a really interesting place. And I don't know how many of you have been at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous where people talk about their hesitancy, their resistance to doing the third step, and if you quiz a sponsoree or a baby, or we call them pigeons in Texas, if you quiz a pigeon about why don't you want to do a third step, they usually come up with this standard rationalization, well, God might make me want to do something I don't want to do. And you'll quiz them even further, what could God possibly make you do that you don't want to do? And they don't want to tell you the truth. So they'll tell you, like, well, I don't want to because God might make me go to Africa. Well, you're looking at someone who did the perfect step, third step of Alcoholics Anonymous, because in 1989 I moved to Zambia, Africa. I remember getting off the airplane in Lusaka, Zambia, and looking out at the African bush. Thinking, my God, Marianne, you have done it now. You have done it now. And then I thought, is God going to strike me drunk? Because I cannot to get to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous at every whip stitch. And this is what happened to me in those years. And I'm really glad, this is going to sound strange, I'm really glad that there's not a whole lot of newcomers here. Because I can talk to you people that are in recovery, that are well into sobriety. What was necessary for me at that time in my sobriety was that I learned to stop once again this frantic activity. And that I learned to go inward. And that I learned to look at me in a different light. I had a tremendous amount of quiet time. I talk about reliance upon the 10th and 11th and 12th step. On Saturday night, I would lay there and hear the African drums. And there was real reason, genuine reason for fear. We had day guards and we had two night guards. And there was coiled barbed wire on our wall. And we had jail doors that shut our bedroom off. And we had bars on the inside of the windows and bars on the outside of the windows. Real fear. You know, the book doesn't say real fear goes away. It says we have the ability then to, the term is, deal constructively with the remaining fear. And the way I would deal constructively would, I would get down on my knees, and what also, and I would say, God help me, and what also I would do is that I would go outside, and of all things, we had a swimming pool. And I would walk around the swimming pool and look up at the moon, and it was always at night. And I don't know how many of you people who have horrible resentments about other members of Alcoholics Anonymous. My resentment list is all free of people on the outside. It's only members of AA that are on my resentment list today. And what happens is, why they're there is because they cross me. Because they touch my ego. And my ego and my pride can't stand it. 6 months ago, at 21 years of sobriety, I identified what that feeling was. I identified what that feeling was and the struggle that went on inside of me when my ego has been touched. And so I would stand there and I would look up at that moon and I'd try to figure out what the hell time it was, because it was 8 hours difference, and I'd say, okay, it's about noon, and they're getting ready to go, and they're getting ready to get their coffee, and they're going into a noon meeting. Or it would be later on, and I think, well, it's 7:55, and so-and-so is straggling in the back, and I know where they're sitting, and I know exactly what they're saying, and I know it's... And all I could think of, the things that I had resented so much in Alcoholics Anonymous, all of a sudden, and none of this is always, never all of a sudden, it doesn't happen that way. But the truth welled up inside of me. If I could just see their faces and hear their voices. That's the moon that's over Las Vegas. That's the moon, the same moon that's over Corpus. That's the same moon that's over Pittsburgh. I got to two meetings. I made my own bread. I ground my own meat. I would go into this place they called a butcher shop, and it looked like they had just done surgery up there. There was, green things and funny-looking things. And I took my Better Homes and Gardens cookbook, and I would go through and say, well, that looks like a rump roast, and this looks like, I think I can get something out of this. I would grind my own meat. I made my own bread. I grew my own vegetables. I took a bath out of a bucket. I learned to shave my legs out of a bucket. I mean, it was next to sobering up, the most life-changing experience I have ever had in my whole life. I remember standing there, the water had gone off one more time, and I'm standing there stomping my feet saying, I'm not carrying water in these buckets. And then I thought, I just kind of chuckled. I thought, I'm going to do exactly what God wants me to do. God had to get me there. God had to get me to that point once more where I was teachable. He had to force me to my knees one more time. I got to two meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in 2 years, and they wouldn't let me drive, and beside they drove on the wrong side of the street, and there was, they kept stopping us periodically. They kept going through our stuff, and so I got to two meetings, and one day the phone rang, and it was the woman from Lusaka. I lived in a little town called Luanshya, Zambia, and she said, we have a 12-step call for you to make. And I said, in Zambia? And it was like Mitchell said last night, duh, yes, it's in Zambia. And I thought, well, there were no other Americans there. And she said, it's a Zambian and it's a man. And I thought, oh, my sponsor says I cannot make a 12-step call on a man. And she said, oh, yes, you can, and oh, yes, you will. And he came to my house, and his name was Costa Kanuga. And Costa Kanuga was a member of the Bimba tribe. And he brought his brother, and we had servants wandering around the house, and the only thing he had ever had to drink was chibuku, and it's a home brew that they bring. He worked in the mines, the copper mines, and he's talking to me about drinking chibuku beer and getting into trouble, and I'm talking to him about drinking martinis at the Skirvin Hotel in Oklahoma City, and I thought, this isn't working. I had an extra big book, and I had the pamphlet, A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it talks about the blind do see, and the lame do walk, and the deaf hear. And I gave him that, and after it was all over with, I really felt like I had let him down, that I had let Alcoholics Anonymous down. And 3 months later, there was a knock on the door, and it was Costa Kanuga, and he had not had a drink in 3 months. From the heart touches the heart. I looked in that man's eyes and I began to give him a 12-step call that you all would have been so proud of me. He talked about the promises. He had heard, read in the little pamphlet about, he said, Madame, will you tell me about the promises? And I put my foot up on the chair and I promised him everything that you people promised me. The self-seeking will slip away, that we will have a whole new psychic change. Our attitude and outlook on life will change. And I didn't have a 3-month chip to give him, and I didn't have a 12 and 12. And so I gave him my 10-year medallion, And I gave him the 12 and 12 that Gene, my sponsor, had given me in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that I had taken to Corpus Christi, Texas, that I had taken to Zambia, Africa. And somewhere in Zambia, Africa, those two items are. My husband came home shortly after that, and he said, he handed me a letter, and it was bad news. And this is why I'm telling you what I do. This is what I do, not what I think, what I do. And I looked at the letter, and I saw that the Zambian government wanted us out of there, and they wanted us out of there right now on their terms. And I took the letter, and I said, just a minute, Bob. And I went into the bathroom, and I got down on my knees in the bathroom, and I said, God, help me. And see, what that does for me is that clears that channel. It talks about the channel being choked. It's choked by jealousy, and it's mostly choked by fear. And so I went back and I sat in the living room and I let him experience his own pain and his own grief and his own fear. Now I am at that point 12 years sober and I did not try to fix him. 12 years. You know why alcoholics and Al-Anons and especially women alcoholics are so quick to fix? It hit me that night. If I can fix you and solve your problems, I can keep your pain away from me so that your pain does not touch me. So my motive for fixing and helping and caretaking was the fact that I couldn't stand it. And he cried, and I kept thinking, I am going to blow apart with this emotional pain. I am going to blow apart. And for the first time at 12 years, I did not act out to get away from the pain. And these were the ways that I have acted out to get away from the pain. I shop. I spend. I eat. I sleep. I read. I watch television. I have sex. You add to the list. We all have this list of ways that we run from the pain. And I stood there at the kitchen sink, and I thought Alcoholics Anonymous had better be right, because I am going to stand here and endure this pain. I'm going to ride it out. I'm going to see what happens to me. I'm going to see if I blow apart in little bitty pieces. I threw the gauntlet down to this fear. I had run from this stuff for years. I had run from it my whole life. And I stood there at the kitchen sink washing dishes thinking, it's just getting worse. And you know how emotional pain does? It gets worse. And it's like a roller coaster. It just keeps going worse and higher and higher. And then the greatest miracle happened to me. It began to level off. And when something levels off, the next thing that happens is it began to dissipate. And I'm standing there 13 years sober going, yes, I am not a coward. I have some character. There is some wherewithal inside of this woman. I have some substance. I don't have to run from this. You can look in my eyes. There is someone home. As a result of getting back to Africa, I'm getting back from Africa. We ended up back in Corpus Christi, and I believe that the amend steps are crucial. And I had done pretty much what everybody had told me to do. My mother and father were dead when I came into AA, and Father Ben said to me, and it's real interesting that several of the speakers previously have talked about their father, and my mother, and I talk about a lot about my mother. You know, I was at a meeting the other day, and a woman talked about, this is conference-approved literature. She said, this is coming from conference-approved literature, and she said, the topic is, and she read this sentence, and it says, most alcoholics suffer from faulty parental relationships. I damn near jumped up out of the chair. I thought, she's lying. That's not in any of our literature. It is. It's in AA Comes of Age, and it's a direct quote from Bill Wilson. See, I had this faulty parental relationship. We either depend too heavily on them and we stay around till we're 40 years old and our parents take care of us, or they do what I do. We get out at the age of 15 so that I never had any role models. I didn't know how to do this. I winged my way through life. I never let anybody help me. And so I had to go along and say to my parents, Mom or Dad, when I'm running one morning, Mom or Dad, wherever you are, please forgive me. And then Father Ben said, you need to add this. And I forgive you. But the circle was incomplete. That's the only thing I can say. You know, the circle of Alcoholics Anonymous was incomplete. And in 1991, I knew exactly the end of the amends. My 90-year-old father-in-law was brought to Corpus Christi, and we put him in a nursing home. And I'm this 9-year-old girl again. I'm standing there, and I'm looking at that nursing home thinking, I can't go in there. I can't do this. It's going to scare me to death. You know, I'm going to faint. I'm going to do all those things. And what happened is that you had done your work on me. And the way I handled it is I would look at my feet and I would walk steps like, God grant me the serenity. That's how I got into that nursing home. And the other thing that happened to me was the psychic change had happened. And from someone who withheld love, I began to carry to this old man the greatest glad tidings of joy you have ever, ever imagined. I took pictures and I brought candy. I told him stories about the kids and the grandkids. And you know, he would say to me, Marianne, you're the best friend I have. He told all the nurses that I was president of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, those of you that know me a little bit know I'm telling you I just tried to dispel that rumor, but I really didn't work very hard at that. And you know, I would do things like he was so frail and they would move him from the bed to the chair or the chair to the bed, and what I would do is what we all do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would pat him and tell him that I was here. When he died, my husband was able to say to me that this man had 2 children and 2 grandchildren and 5 great-grandchildren. But he was able to say to me, Marianne, you made the difference in his life. And I was able to say to him, it was not me. Alcoholics Anonymous made the difference in this man's life. I sobered up with a gentleman who would say, the world truly is a better place now that we don't drink. And I thought, how arrogant. But it's true. The world truly is a better place now that we don't drink. There was another problem that I had to face into. There was a woman who had Alzheimer's. She scared me to death. Her name was Victoria D'Amico. And I would walk in and she would pull on me. And she would yank my skirt and pull me down and mess with my hair and pull my earrings off. And she scared me to death. And what I'd do is go in the back door. And all of a sudden it came to me that Alcoholics Anonymous would not be very proud of me. And so I would go in the front door, and what happened was this. Victoria and I had the most wonderful relationship. If my skirt had an elastic band, I mean, she had the thing of it damn near pulled off, but and I had to introduce myself every day. She always would forget me. One day I went in there, and she had put makeup on her. And I said, Victoria, you just look lovely. You just look beautiful. And she had the most lucid look on her face, and she said, I wanted you to know you're not the only beauty queen around here. Now we're going to get down to why in 1996 I walked into my first meeting of Al-Anon. I'll tell you how I knew I needed Al-Anon. I'm standing outside the door saying, I don't need to go in there. This is a family disease, and why would I think that my family was going to escape it? And I have 2 children. I have a daughter and I have a son, and I began when I first sobered up to look at them. Who's got it? Which one's going to get it? I watched him very carefully, and it didn't take me long to figure out it was my son. And here's where the Alcoholics Anonymous in Tulsa, Oklahoma kicks in. He kept coming down to me in Corpus saying, Mom, I think I have the problem, but I don't want to quit. And AA told me this. Al-Anon didn't tell me this. AA told me this. Remember, less is more. And AA told me this, which is very crucial. You can't help your kids. I'll help your kids if you'll help my kids. And I'm telling you, I prayed that you all were not lying to me. And in 1993, he called and he said, I have the problem, Mom, and I want to quit. And I was able to say to him, call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would like to say to you that I stood back in a lofty way and let Alcoholics Anonymous work. Telling you, I got to intergroup and I got some names in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I began to dial numbers in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm telling you, I'm calling strangers. I'm telling you, I've got this son and here's where he lives. What meeting should he go to? And on. I mean, I am just like, wow, this kid's got to get sober. And he calls and he said, Mom, will you come up? We're going to go to some meetings. And he said, will you go? And I said, yeah. And I got went up there, and he met me drunk, and he said, I've picked out a 6:30 meeting. And I thought, oh, God, we'll miss dinner, you know, this kind of thing. And he said, no, it's 6:30 in the morning. Now, do you know what time I have to get up to get ready to go to a 6:30 in the morning meeting? Well, my son and I drive up to the Unanimity Club in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and the thing that I had feared my whole life as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous happened that morning. There was not a car there. Nobody was at that meeting at that time. And I began to pray the prayer of, you can call it, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous who does not want to see AA go down the tubes. You can say it's a prayer of a member of Al-Anon who finally has gotten their loved one, or who God has gotten their loved one to the doors of Alcoholics. You can say it's just a prayer of someone who cannot do it by themselves. And I said, dear God, please let somebody come. Let somebody come. And sure enough, we came. And last July 19th in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I gave my son his 5-year medallion. I have a 9-year-old granddaughter up there who keeps telling me, Grandma, keep coming back. It works if you work it. Now I'm going to talk to you about some other serious stuff. I thought when I got sober, I'm going to get sober and do grandiose, wonderful, life-changing things as far as the world was concerned. And the truth is, yes. But it was not in the way that I expected. I have these two kids, and I have 5 grandchildren, and I was afraid that I was going to be a drunken grandmother so that they would not let me near these children. And I'm here to tell you that I am absolutely the best grandmother that has ever walked on the face of this earth. I mean, I let them, this one likes to comb my hair, and so I had them all together one day last summer, and she would comb my hair like Bam Bam, and you know, with the little thing on the top. And they all would just laugh at me. I have a 20-year-old granddaughter who comes to me in Corpus every year, and she gets off the airplane and she hands me a pillowcase, and she said, Grandma, I want you to sleep on this pillowcase and don't wash it. And I said, Jessica, why would I not wash it? And she said, when I miss you so much that I can't stand it when I go home, she said, I smell this pillowcase. And she said, I smell you. She's the one when I was 2 years sober and I had her in my arms. You know how you hold a 2-year-old? And she had these little ringlets, these little blonde ringlets, and she had a flower in this hand and a flower in that hand. And I looked at her and I said, oh my God, I adore you. I just adore you. And the next thought that went through my mind was, this hurts. This hurts me. This is why I had run from this my whole life. This is why I had not let anybody get close to me. It hurt. But what I'm telling you is that to let you people in, and to hopefully I have weaseled my way into your heart, is well worth it. The pain that we experience because we love somebody is well worth it. I have a 14-year-old grandson who races cars, and you men now, maybe it would get a little interesting. He races quarter midgets, and he gets out there, and that kid goes around that track. He's been racing him since he's been 9 years old. And I go up there, and I watch him, and I'm okay as long as I'm not watching him. Well, then I watch him, and they're going 45 and 50 miles an hour around this track. And all of a sudden, it's like, oh, my God, he can get hurt out there. And after he has the preliminaries, he'll come up, and he'll say, Grandma, I looked up at you, and you had your hands over your eyes. I said, Spencer, don't look at me. Look at the track when you're going around. So I was out there. I was up there last year, and I mean, I prayed these grand, lofty prayers. I'm trying to fool God is what I'm trying to do. You do any of that praying? If I don't talk about this stuff that's real important, maybe God will give it to me anyway. And I'm praying these lofty prayers about, you know, this blessed son and keep him safe and on and on and on. And just, you know, it's full of shit. What it is I want that kid to win, and I want that kid to win right now so that I can see it. So they're pushing his car out because it won't start, and I finally got real with God, and I said, well, for Christ's sake, let the car start. Let it run anyway. So this car is finally going around the track, and all of a sudden this kid looks like he's going to win. And he won. And he came up in the stands because the winner gets to have their picture taken in the infield behind a winner's placard and their car. And he said, Grandma, I want you to come down. And he said, I want you to get your picture taken with me in the infield. You know, the book talks about how we quit playing the director. I don't know when that stops. I'm coming up on 22 years sober, and this last summer, first of all, I'm going to back up just a little bit, because I'm going to tell you how I got into some big trouble. What happens when people have been around Alcoholics Anonymous for quite a while? What happens is this. We learn how to talk Alcoholics Anonymous. I know how to talk AA till you are screwed into the ground. I mean, I can just talk it and talk it and talk it. And you know how it talks about we clean house? Well, what had happened to me, I had been doing some light dusting. That had been my house cleaning. And in 1997, I am at Midlothian. I mean, I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, is where I was. My granddaughter's graduation from high school. And I'll tell you, you know how we talk about practicing these principles in all our affairs? It's real simple when I don't have anybody in my face. When I've got people in my face, my alcoholism flares. And my desire to control flares. And there were family members and kids, and they were not doing what I wanted, and I'm getting upset. And my husband says something to me, and I whirl on him. I let him have it like you wouldn't believe, and I saw the look. And I thought, shoot. I'm going to have to make amends. So I called him out of the herd like a sheepdog would, and I got him away from all the family members, and we're downstairs, and I start to spout Alcoholics Anonymous. Literally spout it. Please forgive me, I was wrong. It was me, it was not you. Please forgive me. I didn't say I was sorry, because we're not supposed to say I'm sorry. And I'm going on and on and on. Well, what happens is, and I don't know if you've ever been in a fight with a loved one that you've been with since you've been 15. Well, I knew I was beginning to weasel my way back in, and that I was getting back into his good graces, which said to me, I think I'll talk some more. And I just kept talking, which tells you I'm headed for trouble. And I had been in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where I had heard people say, and what can I do to make it right? I thought, good line, haven't used that in a long time. And I said to my husband, and what can I do to make it right? And he looked at me and he said, don't do it again. Don't do it again? No. No, that's not what we in AA do. I had been using tools as weapons. What we in AA do is we do exactly what we want, and we come along and say, I'm sorry, please forgive me, or I was wrong, please forgive me, and then we don't do it for about 6 weeks, and then we go back to doing it again, and then we go back and we make amends again, and then it just goes on and on and on. Here is the success story in Alcoholics Anonymous. Since June the 4th of 1997, I have not done that again. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about, changed behavior. So this last summer, I'm playing the director, and I want to get my 5 grandkids together, and it was just, I did it. I mean, you can imagine, once we set our mind to something, by God, I got them all together. We were in one room in the motel room in Ocean City, Maryland. And I've got a 20-year-old, an 18-year-old boy, a 15-year-old girl, a 14-year-old boy, and a 10-year-old girl. And I knew what this was going to be like. It was going to be, you know, the book says where some of us are in full flight from reality. Well, it was going to be that these 5 kids were going to be around their grandmother's feet, and that they were going to talk lovingly to me, and I was going to tell them stories about when they were babies and how much I loved them. After they quit fighting and farting, was horrible. It wasn't horrible. It wasn't horrible at all. It was the most wonderful time I've ever had in my whole life. I slept with the 20-year-old. The boys are different. You have to approach the boys differently. And what the boys would do is they would let me sit behind them, and they would let me scratch their backs. And we would watch MTV, and we would watch country music videos. And the little 10-year-old at that time, was putting makeup on her. And the 15-year-old, who I think probably is going to be in this room one of these days, has long blonde hair. And she would lay on the bed with her head on my lap, and I would stroke her hair. I wanted time to stop. I didn't want the second hand to move one more second, because these are the rewards of Alcoholics Anonymous. These beautiful children, I can be a grandmother to. For those of you that are old-timers, I have one request. Please keep coming back. I need coattails of courage to hang on to, and that's what this is all about. You must hack out the way for me. I must see you deal with life. I must see you practice quiet heroism, because that's what old-timers do. They're quietly heroic. For those of you that are in those middle of the years, those 5, 6, 7, 8 years of sobriety, I'm telling you to hold on. You know, when I was at that sobriety, the thoughts that go through my mind is that all there is? Is it as good as it's going to get? I come from the school of sobriety that will not tell you it will be okay. It may go to hell, but you will be okay. You will be okay. Hold on. Hold on. And for those of you that are new to sobriety, I'm going to tell you what was told to me. Hang on to your seat, because you're in for the ride of your life. Thanks for my sobriety.